This is the story of a city corrupt and contented, a very unpopular law, and a Marine Corps general who attempted to enforce that law. It took place in Philadelphia. The law was the Prohibition Amendment, and the general was Smedley Darlington Butler, the Fighting Quaker.
There's a patient little woman here below, and a little kid that ought to have a show. Now I'll give the whiskey up, and I'll take a coffee cup with Molly and the baby, don't you know?
At exactly 12:01 a.m., January 17th, 1920, the American people, 105 million strong, began their joyous march into the never-never land of national prohibition, the crowning success of a century of anti-liquor agitation. During the Progressive Era, it had become the conviction of many reform-minded Americans that it was the liquor trade that was threatening the political health of the nation, which is not as far-fetched as it might now appear. Taxes on alcohol accounted for over one-third the federal government's common revenue, and the liquor industry, with a strong lobby in Washington, had become associated with big business, political scandals, and those corrupt and predatory men who used their influence to block political reform and subvert honest government in our nation's cities and towns. In spite of all that, however, the odds are we never would have had national prohibition without America's entry into the First World War. It was pushed through as a war measure, to protect the young sailors and soldiers from corruption, to keep military discipline, and to harbor vital foodstuffs for the war effort. But then when the 18th Amendment passed, the war was over. So what was prohibition like in the city? Philip Price remembers.
Well, it was the great quiz of the nation, of course, because nobody paid any attention to it if they could possibly avoid it. Bootlegging became common and immediate. Everybody had to take their samples of liquor down to the drugstore and have it tested for purity. And a lot of unfortunate people went blind because they had bum alcohol. They drank bum alcohol instead of good alcohol. They got wood alcohol instead of grain alcohol. So that kind of catastrophe. But then the bribery and corruption was became more and more and more conspicuous. Everybody accepted it and said, well, we're stuck with this dreadful curse. Well, you've got to live with it, and that's the only way you can live with it. And I don't know of anybody, well, maybe one or two people, who stopped serving liquor because it was against the law after they ran out of their own stock, but there were very few that were managed to get it somehow. Yeah. Had homes, you couldn't buy it. Except surreptitiously. Well, all the rum runners and all the rest of the thing, there was so much money in it. I forget who were the governor of Pennsylvania was at the time, who refused to allow his the state police to take part in any liquor enforcement activity. Hmm. He said he knew they couldn't possibly stay straight. He was going to have straight police, but he knew they couldn't possibly trust them, anybody, because the temptation was so high. They could be offered thousands of dollars in bribery when they were working for a modest salary, and they all had kids and families, and they just couldn't resist it. So they knew that the police would be corrupted, as they were in every place else. But the state police were perfectly straight and stayed straight all the way through it. Hmm.
What about the city police?
Well, they were just as corrupt as anybody else. Sure. Liquor violations were not considered crime, except by the prohibitionists who brought the whole thing on.
Now, Philadelphia was not a city known for its prohibitionists, but then few cities, especially with large immigrant populations, were. In fact, it was a major brewing and distilling center. And the city was run lock, stock, and barrel by Bill Vere's Republican organization, Wets All the Way, whose income came in part from those industries. No one had any intention of curtailing the traditional arrangements between the saloons and the party's treasury just because of some silly law. Which brings us to the next major character in our little drama, the Philadelphia Police Department, whose reputation on the eve of Prohibition was not the highest. Easy Demitman.
It was a, what at that time was an ordinary police department. It had a lot of weak sisters and had a lot of good men on it. And there's a little graph here and there. It was a big city police department in those days where people weren't as watchful of them. I think the people today watch their government a lot more closer than we did 50, 60 years ago.
In fact, the Philadelphia Police Department was in sorry straits. Jobs, promotions, and precincts were bought or dispensed as favors by the ward bosses, and many officers were physically unfit, overaged, or otherwise unqualified for duty. The police were regularly dunned for the party coffers. Pay was low, and thus often supplemented in other ways. Civil service was a farce. In sum, the department was politically controlled top to bottom, and as a consequence, the police also ran protection and served as collectors for the vice tolerated or controlled by the politicians. When Prohibition came in, then, the rules of the game didn't change so much as the ante was upped. There was more money to be made by everyone, the cop on the beat, his superior officers, the committeemen, and the city committee whose benign management had kept the city plodding along so smoothly and inefficiently low these many years. Yup, things were pretty swell. Then in the fall of 1923, Governor Pinchot blew the whistle. In an address before the state convention of the Women's Christian Temperance Union, he excoriated Philadelphia for the audacity with which it flaunted Prohibition and demanded that something be done. Well, 1923 was an election year, and W. Freeland Kendrick, the Vere-backed candidate for mayor, pledged that if elected, he would clean up the town. A conservative Republican who believed in sound business principles of management, old Freel probably meant it. That's his march in the background. In any case, he promised to bring in a new director of public safety, then head of both the police and fire departments. Someone who was tough, efficient, and free from political influence. Someone with a reputation beyond reproach, who could cope with this dangerous and unusual situation, as Friel put it, and who would clean up crime, close down the speakeasies, and whip a demoralized police force into action. Now who, people wondered, could this man possibly be?
There was a tumult in old Philly, in the staid old Quaker town, and the streets were filled with people, crying, "Grafters up the plum tree! Shake them down! Shake them down!" People gathered at the corners, where they whispered each to each, "Hold-ups, stick-ups, gangsters, boodlers," vibrate in each stifled speech. "Will they do it? Will they do it? Who is prating? What's the news? What of Denby? What of Coolidge? Oh, God grant they won't refuse." Far aloft in that high belfry sits the bellman, old and gray. He is weary of the grafter and his golden sceptered sway. So he sits with one hand ready on the clapper of the bell, where his eye could catch the signal, the long-awaited news to tell. See, see, the dense crowd quivers throughout all its lengthened line as the newsboys, "Extra, extra," belches forth to give the sign. "Ring," he shouts, "ring, spectral bellman, let the old bell shake the air. Butler's coming, crime is going, grafters, boodlers, thugs, beware. Lawlessness and vice be banished, hushed soon be the gunman tongue. Now the city is awakened, follow Butler, brave and young." Quickly at the joyous signal, the spectral bellman lifts his hand. Forth he sends the good news rousing, joyful rapture through the land.
Smedley Darlington Butler, commander of the Marine base at Quantico, veteran of 14 foreign campaigns and winner of 2 Congressional Medals of Honor, had been born into an old Quaker family and grown up in Chester County before running away to join the Marines. He was a man with a spotless record and a reputation for getting things done. He was also willing, once President Coolidge had granted him a year's leave of absence, to take on the job. Thomas Butler was a youngster when his father answered Mayor Kendrick's plea.
What happened was that he had achieved quite a reputation in the Marine Corps by that time because of his various duties. He had been in France during World War I. He had been in most of the Latin American countries. He had been in China. He had achieved a reputation as an organizer, especially in some countries such as Haiti, where he had reorganized the constabulary there and he had gotten into a lot of civilian activities. He had this reputation of getting things done, and especially in organizational lines. I'm not sure how the Philadelphia appointment came about, except that Mayor Kendrick, as I said earlier, was elected on a reform ticket. And Philadelphia was in pretty bad shape as far as bootlegging, enforcement of prohibition, and all that was concerned. And he had heard about my father, and I'm not sure of the details, except that he requested that my father be given leave of absence to take the job, and that was arranged. And it was very difficult because, as you know, the prohibition law was not popular by any means. And that was a pretty difficult job. Speakeasies were rampant everywhere. People had their bootleggers, and that was only part of it. I mean, there was crime in the streets. You talk about crime today, there was plenty of crime then. And that was mainly it, to try to clean up Philadelphia, not only from the standpoint of prohibition, but from the standpoint of crime in general.
There's been a lot of talk about how Mayor Kendrick's appointment of your father was, when your father was appointed, he wasn't really meant to clean things up. He was just meant to be
he was meant to be a whiskered general, you know, that would be a big front and make a big noise. And but my father took the job very seriously, and much too seriously for the politicians. And in those days, of course, those were the days of William S. Vere, who was pretty much the political boss in the city, if not in the state. There were other politicians of that same period. There were some, however, in the mayor's cabinet that my father got along very well with. He made a great many friends in Philadelphia, not only among the city officials, but with the people in general.
The bewhiskered general wasted no time in demonstrating his intentions. On Monday, January 4th, 1924, Butler was sworn in, and no sooner had he kicked out a delegation of prominent political leaders come to help him choose his assistant director than he gathered his lieutenants and told them they had 48 hours to clean up the city or face demotion. The war was on. At the end of the first 48-hour sweep, 973 saloons had been closed and 8 lieutenants suspended. Make no doubt about it, Butler was on the beat.
When I came on as a police reporter in the bulletin, I was working in South Philadelphia, which was the center mostly of the liquor rings and so forth, the stills and all, mostly run by Italians. And that's a part of the story that we can almost...
Bulletin reporter John Calpin.
Testing all these guys being killed. Almost every part of Little Italy down there were stills. But Smelly Butler, bringing something like military discipline to the police department, formed raiding squads under corporals who were almost independent of the police districts. But one of the things he did, and in a way it made my work, or reporter's work, easier, he closed down 5 of the police stations in South Philadelphia. And there were 4 main police stations left: 4th and Snyder, 7th and Carpenter, 24th and Wolf, and 20th and Fitzwater. And they raided nearly every day. As I remember, drugs were not the problem that they are now for the police. Liquor and prostitution were the big illicit crime problems. In closing down the police stations, he also cut back on the fire stations, took away the matrons from the police stations and the fire stations. He would make surprise inspections at 2 o'clock in the morning to see whether the firemen were on duty and sleeping and otherwise. And in every police station, I think mostly it's at 20th and Fitzwater, they had the evidence all around the room, big barrels of confiscated liquor and safes and everything else. You walk into a police station in those days, all you could smell was fermenting liquor and fermenting mash. And he did, Smedley Butler did, pull the police department together.
Precinct inspections at all hours of the night, midnight raids, demotions a handful at a time, redistricting of precincts. Butler meant to whip the police and fire departments into shape. But why redistricting? For Butler, the answer was obvious. You see, in those days, the police districts and political wards shared the same boundaries. It was easier for the ward politicians to control them that way. By redistricting, Butler meant to break that control and to give the cops a fresh start. And it looked like it was working. Burglaries and crimes were way down. Liquor was harder to find. And prohibitionists and reformers of all stripes were thrilled. The general's early campaigns were attracting national attention.
What Butler has done in Philadelphia in a few short weeks can be done throughout the entire country if the people will rise up and support the law,
declared one Mr. Josephus Daniels.
As soon as Butler is finished here, he should be called to Washington and be made national prohibition enforcer.
But the initial euphoria did not last for long. By spring, the Wets had weathered the initial blasts and, with one of the strongest political organizations in their country at their disposal, began a war of attrition. Our story now turns to the Tenderloin, Philadelphia's spicy vice district, home of whorehouses and speakeasies. For years, the Tenderloin had run out in the open, a visible symbol of the Paul's tolerance and interest in vice in the city, and Butler meant to close it down. Redistricting had begun here with the switching of four entire precincts to break its protection rackets. Where then was this land of perfumed indulgence? In 1924, Sam was an insurance collector making his rounds in the Tenderloin.
Well, it was from Coverdale Street to Spring Garden. A really noble in Buttonwood was the end. Spring Garden, up there there was nothing. And it was from 8th Street to 6th, let's say. By most of it around 8th and 9th, and towards 6th Street it dwindled down. And there were old stores or houses, like a noble street had, nice three-story brick houses. And there were women sitting around waiting, and there was a lady at the house that they come in. She took it, she got the lady arrangement, you paid her. And on Coverdale Street, where they had stores, you'd be walking by, and somebody would go, "Come on in, sweetie, come on in, sweetie." Nice, knowing that they go to hell. And I was a young man, otherwise today I'm sure they wouldn't have felt sorry for them, but they come and see me. But it was wide open, and when Butler was here, I had one particular person at 824 Wood Street, a Mrs. Kramer, Jewish woman, had two lovely daughters. They worked in offices, and she ran a house of prostitution. And of course, when Butler was here, it was supposed to be closed psych. And I'd see a policeman standing at the door 24 hours a day, three shifts. And yet, I'd see the customers coming in and out while I was there. Somebody would be leaving. So once I said, "Mrs. Kramer, tell me, what's this going on?" To give you an idea of the corruption. Oh, she says, "Forgive me, plain English. That son of a bitch," she says, "he's standing here counting the customers." He says, "A Friday night when the bagman comes around from the district," they call him the bagman, "and I skipped two customers. The Saturday morning they raid me. Now here's the whole thing down into a few sentences. One little sketch of how the corruption was working."
So even so, Butler's efforts to clean the city up.
No, they immediately listen. I had some policemen I was collecting from. And they wouldn't pay me their insurance. I said, "What's the matter?" He said, "I can't make a nickel." I said, "I can't make a living." He said, "That's so-and-so." He says, he closed everything down tight. "I can make a dollar." But in a short while, they circumvented it. And they were making their dollars again. See, the guy was standing counting the customers instead of kidding them away. And I was letting him know when they're going to come from the unit number one and raid them. And for that, they got paid off. They had their man, the bagman, came up Friday night from the district and collected the money and distributed the money to the cops from the top down and straight down.
You say that all of the activities were carried on right out in the open and on the street.
Oh, yeah.
I'm wondering.
The pimps were standing on the street, on 8th Street and on 9th Street. And their three-shell Monty game, I don't know, you know what that means.
Yeah.
The paper with the three cards. Well, right above our street was a little street, I can't think of it now, 8th Street, in that little street. And they'd be standing there and manipulating the cards and getting the hicks from New Jersey, the farmers, and drop the card and band it and unband it. And then they'd keep on doing this, get two, three, or four guys for $10 bills. And then see where the Baiju movie theater was, the car that Burlesque House. You'd see two cops coming this way, a block and a half above. And they got the lookout, the shield that was standing around, but that was their signal. If they cheated, here come the cops, and they pulled out the newspaper and put it in their car, three cars in their pocket, and then they'd be walking up 8th Street in the direction that the cops were coming. They were coming south and they were going north. And when they got abreast of each other, they go like this. That means that they got three guys. And if they went like this, they only got two. And they paid them off. There, sure. This is what I learned from my own insurance. I tell you, I could write a book on it as I think of it. I never dwell on it. But now that in retrospect, when we talk about it, it seems... You don't get that really. The average person don't realize at the time what this is.
One day I was in the little store across the street from the in back of the 470 Cartman Street police station, phoning, and it was a hot day, and there were two phone booths, and my door was open. I heard somebody come into the next booth. You know, there were a combination of two booths, and I heard this voice say, "You better close up, Joe. We'll be around in a short time." And I walked out of my, finished my call, and he finished his call, and that quit. He was a corporal in the raiding squad. He said, "Hey, kid, we're going to make some raids this afternoon. Do you want to come with us?" He was disarming me, see, and I went with him. They didn't find anything but some mash. They didn't find much, little things of liquor and so forth. But no arrests were made. There wasn't enough evidence.
I was in a couple of places. I was working for the Metropolitan, so I happened to be in my tenderloin with my dad, but I was young then. And I was sitting collecting with my book open when a cop came in and whispered to the lady, "Said, you better get out, they're going to raid me." And 5 minutes later, the squad was there. I was at another place, at Front and Vine Street, Newmarket Street, and a certain party, very wealthy people too. One of their daughters had a speakeasy. And when I was sitting there collecting, a cop came in and whispered to her, and she said, "You better get out, and he's going to raid me." And I stood across the street watching. They came down, they raided her. She had the whiskey, a quarter of a shot, and the milk bottles. And before they raided her, she took all the milk bottles and put them in the crate. See how that's great? Had a little alley in the back and put it in the alley. And when the raid was over, she walked out to the put it back and started the list again. But you couldn't clean this city up.
Crooked cops tipping off speakeasies, collecting from whorehouses and gambling. It was still going on. And Butler was getting angry. In April, he shot off to the press the charge that he'd been betrayed by half his lieutenants who weren't closing the saloons. Even after the establishment of Special Squad No. 1, a crack troop of honest cops who carried out most of the raids, the speakeasies were somehow still being tipped off. At the end of his first year, the job was obviously unfinished. The public demanded, and Kendrick requested another year of the general service, which Coolidge reluctantly granted. Unfortunately, the second year would prove more trying than the first, for even the completion of successful raid was only the first in a series of hurdles. Between arrest and conviction stood the powerful Philadelphia magistrates. An integral part of the party machine and its system of personal service, most of the magistrates came up through the party ranks and dispensed justice as they or the organization saw fit. Police testimony was regularly overturned and the minimum fines imposed upon flagrant and repeated violators. Of the more than 6,000 arrests made in Butler's second year in office, only 212 resulted in convictions. After the magistrates came the Civil Service Commission, which had exclusive power over the firing of police officers. To incidents of extortion, attempted assault, drunkenness, and harassment, the reply was always the same: we find no reason for dismissal in this case. Against such stalwart and entrenched opposition, the general railed loudly and angrily in the press. The path of law enforcement has been blocked by powerful influences, by legal machinery that should have been an aid, and by the invocation of technicalities. Enforcement of prohibition in this city is virtually stopped. The raids continued, the cases backed up in the courts, the general's already strained relationship with the mayor again moved towards the breaking point, and Butler's outbursts in the press became increasingly vitriolic. For the final episode in our story, we have to move away from the party machinery, up Arch Street from the Tenderloin, and down Broad a few blocks south of City Hall. While the war between Butler and the organization flared and sputtered throughout the rest of the city, life had been going on quite peacefully in the major hotels. Hotel bars, of course, served drinks, and society parties maintained tradition. All in all, the high life had remained untouched.
But I know that the Ritz-Carlton and the Bellevue, I think, was involved too. They apparently had no objection, the management of those hotels, whichever, permitted parties to be given in which liquor was served, and that was just going a little bit too far.
Yeah.
And my father got word of it, and he closed them down. I think both the Bellevue and the Ritz-Carlton was across the street from the Bellevue, I believe. That, I think, was the final straw as far as the administration and Freeland Kendrick was concerned.
Yeah, hitting the wrong people.
Precisely that, exactly. And my father had no, it didn't matter how high up a person was, if there was an infraction of the law, he was going to enforce it against the big people as well as the small people.
Butler struck on November 4th, 1925. Close them down, he said. Something has to be done to teach these big fellows that they must obey the law as well as the little fellows. Now, at the time, Philadelphia was preparing for the coming summer celebration of the nation's sesquicentennial, and the hotels were vital to its success. The general's new campaign was at best terribly timed, and on this occasion the mayor not only didn't dare to, but didn't want to back him up. Thankfully, Butler only had another few months in office. And though petitions for his retention had flooded in and Kendrick made the formal request, Silent Cal refused to grant the general another year's leave of absence. Kendrick and the Pauls held their breaths then and prepared to wait out the last few months. Suddenly, however, a few days before Christmas, Butler announced to the papers that he had quit the Marine Corps and was staying on as the Director of Public Safety. Well, this was just too much for poor old Friel. 2 years of dealing with the irascible and often insubordinate general were as much as any reasonable man could be expected to stand. When Butler refused to hand in his resignation, he was fired amidst a flurry of mutual recriminations. The heady days of Butler on the beat were over. Smedley went back to his beloved Marine Corps, where he added still more laurels to an already long and illustrious career. The police reverted back into the hands of the Republican organization, the whole arrangement busting open again in the grand jury investigations of 1928. But more on that later. So what then were the accomplishments of Butler on the beat? Again, easy demitment.
Well, he took a police force that had been ragged and careless and not much pep in it. And put pep, you know, he was a Marine, and they made him act like Marines. And the police force became stronger and more watchful and more alert, and they helped cut down crime. It takes a little lot of effort like that, but it did it. He didn't cut out crime. No one's going to cut crime out in this country. But he did reduce it, because the police became a little prouder of themselves, too, because he gave them a lot of plaudits when they did something nice, and that was it.
There was another unforeseen effect the general's actions had as well, John Calpin.
And Bill Meade, who was the Republican leader of Philadelphia and the leader of the 10th Ward, and his father was leader of the 9th Ward, told me when I first got involved in politics how this worked, about how the when Smedley Butler put the clamps on the police department and gambling and vice and so forth. Gambling was widespread in those days. Hmm. And everybody was getting a hunk of that, the take on that. That in effect, Smedley Butler took it away from the ward leaders and handed it over to the police, not deliberately, but because of the nature of the pressure that was being put on. And Bill Meade told me what happened. He said, if you took a ball of mercury and had it in your hand, it would just stay there. But if you squeezed it, and he said it would run out. Oh, and that's what happened to vice in Philadelphia. That instead of being contained in the Tenderloin or now around 13th and Locust, that it spread out all over the city, just like as you squeeze a ball of mercury.
So how should we sum up the strange case of Butler on the beat? The story of Prohibition in Philadelphia is really not that much different from that in any of the nation's other big cities. There was just too little public support and too much money to be made. What Philadelphia had that a New York or Chicago lacked was the irascible and unbendingly honest General Smedley Darlington Butler.
Philadelphia, my hometown, my hometown.
I remember when Time's Gone But Not Forgotten is written and produced by Charles Hardy. Funding for this program has been made possible by grants from the Pennsylvania Humanities Council, the Colonial Pen Group, which specializes in promoting insurance, travel, and temporary employment services for America's older persons, the Margaret Durant Strawbridge Foundation, and the Philadelphia Industrial Development Corporation, the firm which helps you relocate, expand, modernize, and finance business in Philadelphia. Contributors to today's program include Thomas Butler, John Calpin, Easy Dimitman, Ed Curlin, Philip Price, and Sam Spritz. The engineers were Scott Williams, Joyce Lieberman, and Rob Richards. Your host, Charles Hardy.
The Prohibition Amendment, the Volstead Act, was a thing that hurt every city that had a police department that could be venal.
Happy people lead in every line. Right near King Donald came to come, he anchored right here. Philadelphia all the time.